Will Duval County play a role when it comes to the president's hopes of winning Florida a second time? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, don't miss it as Jacksonville's top pollster breaks down the 2020 matchup and Florida's importance. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, another Amendment 4 will be on your ballot this November, but voting rights groups say its intent is murky at best. We'll speak with the League of Women Voters about that. But first this hour, the latest numbers on the pandemic. Wednesday, the Florida Department of Health reported the rate of positive tests around the state has dipped statewide to 5.3%. Good news. The numbers are down in Jacksonville, too. The positive rate for COVID in Duval County is 4.6%. However, the positive test rate for the disease went up in Baker, Nassau, and St. John's counties. Baker County has a positive rate for coronavirus of above 11%. Against those numbers, President Trump is holding a rally in Jacksonville tonight. Anyone who attends must sign a waiver acknowledging that they run the risk of contracting COVID-19 and cannot sue the president or his campaign if they get sick. At the same time, there were protests around the nation last night after a grand jury decision in the Breonna Taylor case in Louisville. And yesterday, at the White House podium, the president said he would not commit to a peaceful transfer of power if he loses the election in November.
Will you commit to making sure that there is a peaceful transferal of power after the election?
Well, we're going to have to see what happens. You know that I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots, and the ballots are a disaster.
I understand that, but people are rioting. Do you commit to making sure that there's a peaceful transferal of power?
We want to get rid of the ballots, and you'll have a very peaceful, there won't be a transfer, frankly. There'll be a continuation. The ballots are out of control. You know it. And you know who knows it better than anybody else? The Democrats know it better than anybody else. Go ahead.
Get rid of the ballots. Get rid of the ballots. The President of the United States yesterday said, for the first time ever in this nation's history, that he would not adhere to the bedrock of our system of government. The beacon of hope we send out to the entire world. The peaceful transfer of power. We're going to discuss this now with Mike Binder. He heads up the Public Opinion Research Lab on the UNF campus. They're polling the 2020 election, and they're working with the New York Times on this effort now as well. Mike Binder, always good to get your insights. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me today.
We'll go to your calls in a moment at this extraordinary time. It's 549-2937. Join us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Mike, there's so much to ask about your work at the polling lab, but first I really must begin with what happened yesterday amidst nationwide unrest over the killing of Breonna Taylor in Louisville and officers being shot in Kentucky over that grand jury decision. Yesterday, the President of the United States said he would not commit to a peaceful transfer of power pending the outcome of the election. He said that the ballots were out of control. They are not out of control. Mail-in balloting is safe and secure and has worked just fine, by and large, for quite some time in a number of states, including this one. This is a grave moment we are at in America right now, and I want to begin there. It is extremely worrisome for a president to say he will not accept the peaceful transfer of power, depending on the outcome of the election.
It is, and I don't want to diminish the statements that he made. However, if you're a detractor of President Trump, and regularly you see him telling things that aren't true, making statements that are half-baked, I'm not ready to sit here and say that Donald Trump has just said he's not leaving the White House. I think this is very much in line with a lot of the things that he said to fire up his supporters and to cast doubt on the election. And you're right. This is something that is unlike anything we've seen in presidential elections in our lifetimes and in our history. So I don't want to diminish that. But I'm not ready to say just yet that we have an enormous constitutional crisis and our democracy is at stake of falling to pieces just yet.
There's reporting in The Atlantic this week, according to sources in the Republican Party at the state and national levels, the Trump campaign is discussing contingency plans to bypass election results and appoint loyal electors in battleground states where Republicans hold the legislative majority. That would presumably include Florida. With a justification based on claims of rampant fraud, Trump would ask state legislators to set aside the popular vote and exercise their power to choose a slate of electors directly. So, in effect, what this reporting is saying is that if the president were to lose the vote, he would ask governors like Ron DeSantis to swing their states to him, even if he lost that state.
And that is where things potentially become more problematic, both for the country, but also for his plan and potential scheme. This all assumes that he loses. All right, this is by no means a guarantee that he actually loses this election. I want to put that out there. But certainly, it would require not only individual governors, but state legislatures as well, going along with such a plan. And it's always important to remember that all these governors and all these state legislators are facing an election again, many of them 2 years from now. The idea that this is something that is likely to occur is doubtful, but certainly within the realm of possibility. So it's something to be wary of. But again, we're not at that point yet. And I say that because, A, Trump could very easily win this election, much like 2016. I think it's really clear that he's not going to win the popular vote nationally, and he's probably going to lose by more than he did in 2016. But that doesn't mean he can't legitimately win enough electoral votes to win the presidency again. And if that happens, none of this matters. It's also possible that it's, you know, not even close, and none of these actual states are really in any type of debatable or contestable situation. And so then that wouldn't be a problem either. If it's close and he loses, it might get a little dicey.
All of those are important points. That said, I think it's important that we not normalize what's happening. This is abnormal, and this is the kind of rhetoric you hear from leaders in third world authoritarian countries.
Yes, I won't deny any of that. That's absolutely correct. This is outside the bounds of traditional United States democratic actions. But that being said, there's a lot of people in this country that are on board with this guy. And it's also important to think that they don't necessarily take him at his word. And so for us and for people that are opposed to Donald Trump, us kind of analyzing or in the media and people on the other side, you know, if his supporters often don't take him directly at his word, you know, we need to be careful at analyzing and parsing every word that comes out of his mouth, too.
I want to ask you about your work at the Public Opinion Research Lab. You're polling Florida, of course, and as the president prepares to appear in Jacksonville tonight, you have been contracted by the New York Times Siena College Poll to conduct battleground state polling in this election. So kudos to your lab. Let's talk about Jacksonville and Duval County, because this county could play a pivotal role in the outcome of Florida on election night. What does your research show?
Sure, certainly. Listen, Duval County has always been a reliably red county. And in 2018, that changed dramatically. Andrew Gillum won handily. Bill Nelson won. So, you know, maybe things are a little bit different now. And in fact, just based on voter registration statistics, in 2016, Democrats had a +3 registration advantage in Duval County over Republicans. Right now, that's up to +6, a little more than +6. So the gap is widening. Duval is changing. This is not the same county that it was 10, 15, 20 years ago. And it looks to us that, you know, this is a very, it's going to be a close race. And I certainly think that Joe Biden has a really good opportunity to win Duval County, particularly if the African-American vote turns out closer to the way they did in 2018 and closer to the way they did in 2012, as opposed to what happened in 2016 or even 2014.
Let's go to some calls now for UNF pollster Mike Bender. It's 549-2937. Linda is in Mandarin. Linda, good morning.
Yes, Melissa. Welcome back to me. I just wanted, I'm so glad you...
Linda, get off your speakerphone if you could.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just wanted to thank you for, you know, making the point about not normalizing, and I know the pollster wants to even everything out. But, you know, if we wait until after November 3rd to find out whether or not he is being literal, then we're behind the eight ball. My mother used to say, be prepared, expect the worst, and be prepared for that, hope for the best. But we need to be prepared. Just because we haven't seen this before does not mean. The president has been... That was the first time he said it out loud at a podium, very directly to a question. But he's been messaging all year that he is not necessarily open to leaving. He's going to interpret. They're getting ready. They got a ruling yesterday in Pennsylvania that there are potentially 100,000 mail-in ballots. So when anybody talks about it, and his supporters who always talk about freedom, is freedom if a person will not adhere to the Constitution who leads our country? This is terrifying. Many immigrants in our country ran away from dictators just like what he's proposing. We don't need to normalize this. We need to take him for his word. And whatever he says, don't let's say he doesn't understand. He's the president. He knows the power he can yield. And I just am concerned that by the time people wake up and find out that he's real, that we'll be on November 5th, and he'll be wrenching away power and declaring himself, you know, the 12-year thing he said he wanted to be president for 12 years. Thanks a lot. Take care.
Thank you, Linda. Mike Bender, a moment ago, you gamed out a number of scenarios that could happen after election night, and you correctly pointed out that this is a nearly evenly divided state and a partisan and polarized country. All of that said... I have to come back to what I said at the top of the hour. Never in the history of America has a president questioned the peaceful transfer of power. And never in the history of America has a presidential campaign said they plan to tap legislative majorities in states that are favorable to them to choose their own slate of electors to bypass the will of the voters. This is absolutely unprecedented, and I do think people of all political persuasions should be greatly concerned about even the potential of these kinds of maneuvers.
Certainly, and I'm not here to say that everything's normal and this is how the process should work, but I'm urging caution as far as jumping off the bridge about the craziness of what's happening. Listen, for many, many election cycles, close elections have ended up in the courts. And, you know, just look back to 2000 here in Florida about what people perceived as unfair political influence in the system and ultimately picking a president that, you know, may not have been reflective of the will of the people. So it's not the first time that something like this has potentially occurred. The methods might be a little bit different, at least the proposed methods. But again, we're not there yet. And certainly, I think we need to be aware of these things. And I think we need to hold our elected representatives accountable. But listen, if you're very worried about this, make sure you and all your friends show up to vote and have your voice heard one way or the other. You know, if this election is not close, it's not an issue.
If it is close, I think the legitimate concern many voters have on both sides is that all of the ballots won't be counted because so many of them will come in as mail-in ballots. Now, here in Florida, they will not count any ballots that arrive after 7 p.m. on election night. But other states have different rules. They will be counting ballots for days or even a week or two after the election. What about that concern?
I think this is where Florida, in a very weird sense, might be the shining city on the hill, if you will, about how to conduct an election. Because Florida counts their mail ballots as they come in, when we watch the TV at 7 or 8 o'clock, whenever the polls close, and you start to see the results popping in for all the counties, those results will include mail ballots that have been received and tabulated. So there are already ballots that have been sent in to the Division of Elections that have been calculated and tabulated right now today for this election. So when those initial results pop up, those will all be counted in there. What you'll be seeing throughout the night are updates from same day voting on election day, and then also additional mail ballots that came in the day before or maybe on election day itself. Other states don't start counting until election day, which is really different than what Florida does. And what that's going to lead to is in a state like Florida, and it's a lot of research has shown this, the Democrats are way outpacing Republicans with early mail ballots. If Biden has a big lead, as those votes come in from election day, Trump is going to close the gap because Republicans are much more likely to show up on election day. Other states, it's going to be the opposite result. Trump's going to have a big lead from the election day voters, which get tabulated right away. But then as the absentee ballots start to get counted and the mail ballots start to get counted, Biden is going to have an increase or an uptick in votes, and he's going to close the gap. And that's where you can expect to see Trump crying foul, making arguments that these ballots are rigged and the process is corrupt.
So because Florida's 29 electoral votes are so important, what I hear you saying is if it's clear that President Trump has won Florida, it could all be over on election night or vice versa for Joe Biden.
I think it's much more likely that if Biden wins Florida, the election is over for Trump. There is a clear path for Biden to win without Florida. It obviously makes it much easier if he has Florida. But if Biden wins Florida, the odds of Trump winning the election plummet dramatically.
Let's go to John on the South Side. Hi, John. Good morning.
Good morning, Ms. Melissa. The issue is that we as American people, we have a perception that our voting and our democracy is so free and open, but the real reality of it is this. The Electoral College was designed when America was in a racist system. White women couldn't vote, neither black men or black women couldn't vote. The Electoral College was set up to keep the older group in power. Now here we is, 100 years later, we have all this technology, and then all of a sudden, we sitting up telling people that, oh, get out and vote, get out and vote, your vote matters. But we done seen last year where, hey, this guy wins when he wins the Electoral College, but he loses the popular vote. Is not the popular vote every vote count? So if we're talking that America is a democracy, but yet we play by a system that allows a person to win the presidency without the most votes, I don't know no game in America where anybody plays a game and the person that gets the less votes wins. But this is how our system really is. We must educate the American people on how their system works. Now, the young man just said about how these scenarios can go in effect if things are challenged. Let's go to 2000. When we had 2000, okay, for me, by the Constitution, that was an illegal election because he was appointed by the court. The Constitution says if any president is not by the people and for the people, hey, can't be president. We should have revoted. But no, we held it and we went along with it. And what did happen? What happened? We got 20 years of a war that has cost America about $7 trillion, and our young, innocent Midwestern blood, because that's where they recruited most of the 18-year-olds out of high school, and now here we is, we
okay,
got a
John.
President standing on the podium.
Yeah.
You know, so okay. I'm telling you, Miss Melissa, we must stop the charade and teach the American people and their children how their system really works.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Miss Melissa.
Thank you, John. Mike Bender, certainly on the left. If there's another big mismatch on November 3rd or in the days after between the popular vote and the Electoral College, as we saw in 2016, the calls are going to grow very loud to abolish the Electoral College, which would be very difficult to do. I'm glad that that caller pointed that out, because I think the Electoral College is one aspect of our electoral system that is under strain and that has become more and more controversial with the changing demographics of this country. And as you poll here in Florida, too, what are your thoughts about his comments?
So it's true, right? The Electoral College is not a straight one person, one vote type of situation, but its history is based in the idea that states have their own sense of sovereignty. And in the federal system that we're in, states have a lot of authority and a lot of power. And the idea was that a lot of the small states could just get run over by the big states. And in 200 years ago, that was Virginia and New York were the big states. And they'd be getting small states like New Jersey and Connecticut and Delaware would just get washed away. So that's the Electoral College was really designed to maintain some authority for the small states and give them a more close say. And we see that, right? A lot of the states, very small states without a lot of population, have disproportionate representation in the Electoral College. And that was by design in order to maintain some of our state sovereignty. So that's important to think about. You know, how important is individual state sovereignty for us as a country? Is that something we want to essentially forfeit and move to a straight popular vote option? So there's a lot to think about. And yes, you indicated it is going to be nearly impossible, especially if Trump were to win re-election, to get rid of the Electoral College anytime soon. I mean, you need constitutional amendments, which take a lot of votes and states and Senate and Congress and all kinds of stuff to happen.
Jose emails the show, I have never heard of an administration in any country claiming that the opposition had the power to manipulate the election in their favor. Actually, it's the administration in power that has the ability to manipulate the election in order to remain in power. Here is a tweet from Carrie. Mike Bender said Trump has supporters who don't fully believe him, but that's what was said about Vladimir Putin, Duterte, and Erdogan. Brazil is in dire straits, too. So, Mike Bender, I think that tweet reflects the alarm millions of Americans feel as they see the rise of authoritarianism and strongmen dictators and strongmen leaders around the world. And they see the same kind of rhetoric coming out of the president's mouth. And we're getting, the people are worried is what I'm saying to you.
Oh, and they should be. And I'm not diminishing that. And they should be worried, they should be concerned, all of those things. One thing I want to do point out that tweet about that the party in power really has control over the elections and the out party shouldn't have influence on that. The thing with the United States is there isn't just one election. Elections are run at the state level, and they're really implemented at the county level. So in a sense, we don't just have one election. We have 10,000 different elections, and you have different governors of different parties, legislatures of different parties, supervisors of elections in different counties of different parties. So you have a very diffuse system. So it's not just one party in control. There are, depending upon where you are, you have different levels of influence and control over each of these elections.
Thank you so much for that. And again, I want to give congratulations to you, Mike, because the Public Opinion Research Lab, which does such great work in this state, has been tapped by the New York Times Siena College poll, and their results will be featured on the New York Times website in the weeks leading up to this election. So, Mike, thanks for your thoughts and congratulations.
Hey, thanks a lot, Melissa.
All righty, and much more still ahead. Later, we speak with former Sonic Youth frontman Thurston Moore about his new solo album. But up next.
There are a lot of unknowns behind the money and the people responsible for number four.
Why voting rights groups are raising alarm about the new Amendment 4 on your Florida ballot this fall. That's next.
Turntable Tuesday can now be heard on Anthology on the WJCT app and 89.9 HD3. For the best on vinyl, listen to Anthology Tuesdays at 9. Turntable Tuesday, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9. Welcome back. This November, Florida voters will be asked to decide the fate of Amendment 4. Now, this is a different Amendment 4 than the 2018 ballot amendment that restored voting rights to former felons. This amendment, critics say, would make it much harder for all of us Florida citizens to change the state constitution. It would make it tough to get any amendment on the ballot at all. Patricia Brigham is president of the League of Women Voters of Florida, and I spoke with her about the new Amendment 4. Take a listen. Patricia Brigham, it's good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you again.
Tell us about your position with the League of Women Voters of Florida when it comes to dark money in our politics. This has to do with a proposed constitutional amendment voters will be asked to decide. It's also called Amendment 4, which sounds like another amendment we voted on a couple of years ago. What's happening with all of this?
Well, it sure does sound like the other Amendment 4, and we are calling this Amendment Number 4 because we don't want Floridians or Florida voters confused about the numbering of this amendment. So it is Amendment Number 4. We are always concerned in the League of Women Voters about any lack of transparency when it comes to governance. And there is a lot of unknown, there are a lot of unknowns behind the money and the people responsible for number four. And when we are voting to put a initiative or an amendment into our Constitution, the sponsors have the responsibility to be as transparent as possible as to who they are, where the money is coming from. Because after all, a constitutional amendment, once you put it in, it's almost impossible to get it out. And the voters have that very heavy responsibility when they cast their ballot on an amendment. So they need all the information necessary to make an informed and responsible vote.
So you're asking a group called Keep Our Constitution Clean to disclose the anonymous donations that have been coming into this PAC to bankroll the effort around Amendment Number 4. What would Amendment Number 4 do if it passes?
Well, the initiative is very disturbing because, as we've seen the legislature whittling away at the citizen initiative process in Florida for the past several sessions, this initiative, if passed, would put the final nail in the coffin of getting a citizen initiative onto the ballot, which is already extremely challenging because it takes millions of dollars, hundreds of thousands of petition signatures, and a state Supreme Court review. If number four passes, only the wealthiest of the wealthy would be able to get an initiative onto the ballot. And it's important to know who is behind this initiative, since we have seen the legislature whittling away at direct democracy in the state of Florida.
So we don't know who's behind this effort, who's bankrolling it, but if it passes, the upshot of it is it would just be much more difficult for the average voter to weigh in about changes to the Florida Constitution. That's the bottom
Absolutely.
Line.
Absolutely. Yes, the bottom line is that we have an ongoing situation in the state of Florida where when you have one-party rule and no parity in the legislature or the cabinet, then the citizens, in order to get their needs met or their values addressed, weigh in through this initiative process. That would be extremely limited and much harder to do were number four to pass.
Well, you know, even when amendments pass, Patty, often the legislature finds ways around them. Amendment 4 from 2018 is just one of many examples. Florida voters overwhelmingly said people who'd served their time in prison should have their voting rights restored. But the legislature then came back and passed its own law that said, nope, not until they can pay all fines and fees, which most of them cannot afford to pay or find out even how much they owe. So even when we pass constitutional amendments, that doesn't necessarily mean they'll ever be executed in the way voters intended.
Alyssa, you're absolutely right. Our legislature has a long history of maneuvering the initiatives or amendments once they pass into something that is not necessarily the version that the voters voted on. So yes, that's true. But at the same time, two wrongs don't make a right. It's not right for the legislature to do that, to go against the will of the people, as they did when they passed 2018's Amendment 4 to restore voting rights to ex-felons, nor is it right for a dark money group to try to get an initiative on the ballot to close the door once and for all on direct democracy, except for billionaires.
Okay, so you're asking then for voters to vote down Amendment Number 4 since you perceive that it's not on the up and up. You're a nonpartisan organization, but
right.
When you talk about one-party rule in Florida and these kinds of attempts to subvert our system of governance, I should say, I mean, for two decades plus, the Republican Party has had control of Tallahassee. So are you advocating that the Republicans be voted out because...
No. We are not advocating that Republicans be voted out. We wouldn't care if it were the Democrats solely in charge. We believe there should be parity in government. And right now, and for a long time, there has been no parity in the legislature or the cabinet. When you have just one party in charge, no matter the party, you create a situation when there is not true equity and that all the voters' needs are being addressed.
Patricia Brigham is president of the League of Women Voters of Florida. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Well, local coffee roaster Bold Bean is brewing up a new blend to help support a local nonprofit. It's the EVAC movement. Now, EVAC empowers local young people to create change on issues that impact them. We are so pleased to welcome Zach Burnett, managing partner for Bold Bean Coffee Roasters. Hi, Zach.
Hi, Melissa.
Also on the line, Jay Harris, lead pastor at the Ville Church and an EVAC mentor. Hi, Jay.
Top of the morning, Melissa. How you doing?
I'm great, thanks. In a moment, Jay, we'll talk all about EVAC and what it stands for. But first, Zach, tell us why you're brewing up a special blend for this particular group and what that's all about.
Yeah, so I was introduced to Jay and Amy from EVAC a few months ago through some friends and clients of ours, Chase and Brooke Sams at the Mini Bar. And when I first met Jay and Amy, and they started telling me the story about EVAC and how it was instrumental in not only saving lives of the youth who go through the movement, but in strengthening the overall community as well. It just was something that synced up with the values that we have at Bold Bean and something that we really wanted to be able to support.
So people can have this coffee to support EVAC. Pastor Harris, tell us about the EVAC movement.
Yeah, EVAC was a, it pretty much started unintentionally. We, you know, Miss Donna Frio actually attended my church, and she was teaching at Lee High School, and just called me one day and said, "Hey, Jay, I'm leading this class of kids, and I need some help." And so one of the things she told me right off the bat was, "Don't even come do this if you're not willing to make the long, long walk with these kids. Like, this might be something that actually takes years, but don't pop in and pop out." And we started the class, and I think the first month or two when I went in the classroom, I drove home weeping because I couldn't believe the stories. I couldn't believe how many kids were getting killed. I just really simply was unaware of all the things that were happening inside of this class. I mean, it was just one classroom, and it was overwhelming. And so EVAC kind of was just birthed from this us hearing the kids' stories, because our biggest thing was they need to speak. We need to hear their voice. And once they started telling their stories, they started finding so many similarities in some of the trauma and the experiences that they were going through, and it kind of started to knit us together as a family. And we were like, this is actually becoming something. And so we tried our best to kind of move out of the way and let their voice be loud and kind of lead what we were doing.
The EVAC group has gotten national attention all over the country. The White House recognized you, Harvard University. You were on the front page of the New York Times. But unfortunately, the class at Lee High School that worked with these kids got canceled. And so you're trying to bring the movement back. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. I think... We have a long list of just amazing things that have happened through this class that I think are just, you'd be hard-pressed to find a group with basically no budget, but just dreaming, ideas, ambition, sweat equity, and being able to sit in front of, you know, the president's financial advisors or in the White House or in front of, you know, the Bill Gates Foundation and present. And this is the youth that are actually speaking, not us jumping in front of them and talking for them, but them presenting their own case. And we need that in the school system, but I honestly think that it's scary when you start talking for people. In my humble opinion, they're actually smarter than a lot of us, number one. And they're actually on ground level, and they're able to articulate their stories very well. And I think a lot of what we see going on as far as in the future of, you know, just education and even where our country is going right now, we really need kids to be heard. We need to hear their energy. We need to hear their experiences. They're brutally honest, and it hurts our adult egos sometimes, but they really, really need to be heard. And so we think that this is important to remain inside of the school system. You know, when I was in high school, I was in and out of trouble, and I was in and out of juvenile, and I was really lost, and I needed somebody to show up and speak to me and encourage me and help me actually find out what my, you know, who I was, and some of the giftings that I was using for bad, they would serve in areas, but I just never had access to those areas. And I really want our kids to have somebody standing next to them in an organization like EVAC that pulls them out of their circumstance and let them realize their powers and their talents. And so I think it's important. I think it's vital, actually.
Well, people can go to your change.org petition and sign it to bring EVAC back to Lee High School. And Zach, they can support these great efforts by just going to Bold Bean and buying a bag of your EVAC coffee. All through the month of September, you're donating all the profits. Tell us a little bit more about that and some of the other things you're doing at Bold Bean to throw support behind this.
Yeah, that's correct. So if you buy a bag in our shops or online as well, if you can't make it into the shops, we're donating 100% of the profits to EVAC all month. And we'll continue to sell that coffee after September through our website as well and donate a portion of the profits back to EVAC. And, you know, I think really what we want to offer EVAC more than, you know, just money donated to them is really using our platform to give them a bigger voice and a voice to some people that they might not have been able to speak to or not yet been speaking to. So that's what's been really I think good with this partnership is just getting more people locally aware of what EVAC is doing. You know, they've gotten a lot of attention nationally and even internationally. But right now, I think what's needed the most is that attention locally to get EVAC back into the school system.
And you've had members of the movement at your Riverside shop to pour out some free samples of the EVAC blend. Is that happening today?
No, that's not happening today, unfortunately. That was a few weeks ago when we launched it. And we also had some of the youth who are part of the movement in at the roastery to help us actually develop the blend that was going into the bag as well.
But people can stop by any Bold Bean and buy the EVAC blend to support this movement and this group. And Pastor Harris, what else can people do to learn more and support these kids?
Yeah, definitely. If people can head to evacmovement.com, and a lot of our story is actually centered there, also on our Instagram, and keep up to, with the different things we have going on. And also, I mean, this we fund this out of our own pocket and from people who are just generous and for our movement and want to see us move forward and do some more amazing things. So they can support through that. But I also tell you that that coffee is absolutely amazing. It's an Ethiopian blend, and it's some good stuff. If you love coffee, you definitely want to drop in the Bold Bean and get your bag.
So do that, everybody. And you should go to Bold Bean anyway because it's great. A locally owned coffee chain. Stop by and buy the EVAC blend and support the EVAC movement. You can go to evacmovement.com. You can look at the change.org petition. You can follow the hashtag BringBackEVAC. And I want to thank you both, Jay Harris, EVAC mentor, and Zach Burnett at Bold Bean Coffee Roasters. Guys, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
Well, in a moment, don't miss it, as Sonic Youth singer Thurston Moore joins the show. His new solo album, By the Fire, is out today. We'll take a listen and talk to him about what it's like to be a musician in this time of pandemic. That's after this.
I'm Robert Scott. I've been a sustaining supporter of WJCT for over 10 years now. I listen to WJCT all the time, and I have since I was a young adult. One of my favorite shows is actually a local show, and that's First Coast Connect. One of the great values, I think, is listeners are invited to call in. By the end of the hour, I'm definitely more informed about an issue. It's also made me think about it a lot deeper than I probably would have. This is WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Marco Werman. PRI's The World brings you more than just a day's news.
Well, the poor old British pub has been around for 2,000 years.
We introduce you to people around the globe.
I'm a Liberian, but I'm part of Africa.
If we were only in Argentina.
I think it's a Scottish thing, you know? This sense of doom there, but it's always kind of amusing to us.
Join us and hear The World. Weekday afternoons at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
The First Coast Freethought Society Book Group will discuss Jill Lepore's These Truths, A History of the United States, beginning at 3 p.m. Sunday, October 4th via Zoom. Details at firstcoastfreethoughtsociety.org.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Craig Fugate, the former director of Florida Emergency Management. In this time of COVID, you need to update your hurricane preparedness plan. That means knowing what evacuation zone you live in, and if ordered to leave, you need to go. Take your pets and stay with family or friends, or at an inland hotel. Shelters are another option. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorms.org. That's floridastorms.org.
WJCT Public Media and StoryCorps invite you to have a conversation with someone new from across the political divide. To learn more or sign up, visit wjct.org/OSS.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a pioneer in the fight for gender equality going back to her early days as a lawyer.
She engendered all kinds of hope, all kinds of conviction that this was all going to happen. We just had to keep demanding and we had to keep the flame lit.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, Ginsburg's strategy for fighting gender discrimination. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9.
Equal pay and opportunity between the sexes has always been a problem. At a pandemic, and it's a vicious cycle that forces millions of mothers out of the workforce. I'm Jen White. 2020's impact on working women is already considerable. We'll find out why it could be generational next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Thurston Moore is the co-founder of Sonic Youth, an avant-garde band whose artful noise influenced an entire generation of alternative and indie rockers. He's still making music and drops his seventh solo album today. I recently spoke with Moore about that new album, By the Fire, as well as how the pandemic is impacting his music and the industry. So tell us a little bit about the new album, By the Fire. Does that refer to current events, maybe 2020, or what is that? What's that all about?
I guess there is a reference to 2020 for sure. I mean, I wanted definitely to have this record come out this year, especially when this year started unfolding the way it did. I felt stronger and more focused on how I wanted to sequence the record and how I wanted to present it. Emotionally. So calling it By the Fire was a title that had been bandied about beforehand, but it came into more sort of focus as we sort of entered into this shared global quarantine situation. The title was sort of inspired by the viewing of a documentary on Joe Strummer of The Clash that the filmmaker Julian Temple had made, Julian Temple is a filmmaker who was involved with Malcolm McLaren and the Sex Pistols and The Clash and everybody, and he documented a lot of that scene and made some interesting films, and one of them was The Future is Unwritten, which is a documentary about Strummer. And he used this device in the film where he had all the musicians and artists who Joe Strummer knew before he began The Clash and kind of got radicalized by punk rock. He was like in this more sort of kind of politically conscious rock and roll band called the 101ers. And so those people who were involved with him at that time were sitting around a campfire and sharing stories with the campfire crackling. And I just thought that was really wonderful because in a way it was referencing this really sort of primal communication that people have always had of sitting around campfires and talking and dialoguing and debating and passing the peace pipe, as it were. And I really like that image. And so I was thinking of that. And as we got into so much unrest with people being completely angry at being marginalized and oppressed in a lot of the world, particularly in the USA this year, which was building up for the last 4 years in such a big way. And where it got to the point where just fires were erupting in the streets, that just became another image to think about. And so, but I wanted the record to sort of have a more positive kind of perspective. I always think there's this politics in joy that kind of overrides as an activist measure against oppression and anger. And I believe in that. And so I kind of went, the record sort of starts out with these kind of more joyful kind of sonic rock tunes. And it gets a little more introverted and possibly darker as it moves into the center of the album. And then it sort of has this deliverance at least I think of it as a deliverance at the end, with this long instrumental called Venus that kind of moves out into this kind of purely musical and hopeful space.
We're excited to listen to a little bit now of By the Fire, and I want to thank you, Thurston Moore, for sharing your thoughts about this new music with us. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for being radio, something that we could all sort of share in the safety of our home. So that's really important.
And pick up that album today. That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. And Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Keep those emails coming. We appreciate your feedback. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything from today's show, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock on this radio station. Or our podcast will be up later today, wherever you listen to yours. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll connect with you again tomorrow at 9 a.m. for our Friday Media Roundtable. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.